Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by those lovely people at Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Want to poach some fish? Boiling hot water straight into the pan. Job done. Cook some veg, make some pasta, make some rice. Everything in the kitchen is easier with a Cooker tap. If you can afford one, I recommend them. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details and to see the designs. On today's hour, I'm curious how to shop well to save money. Perfect timing with Christmas coming up. Unless you're listening to this after Christmas. Well, there's still another Christmas coming up, I suppose, at the end of the year. There's always a Christmas coming up. Just left one, there's one coming up. Joining me to discuss this is comedian, podcast host, and financial PR person, Victoria Layton. Fascinating story she's got too. You're going to enjoy this. I tell you what, I'm not going to tell you. Let's just meet her. Learn loads about everything to do with finance and comedy and podcasting. Let's talk to her. Here's Victoria. Victoria. Do I call you Victoria or Vix?
Well, it depends if you're telling me off. So I guess we'll see how the tone goes from here.
Okay. So I'll even though I want to tell you off because you're a little late for the podcast. What have you been doing? Why are you late? What happened?
It's just public transport issues. It's very boring. But I will be getting compensation.
Needless to say, yeah, and getting around. How are you? Are you well? Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm pretty good, actually. I think I've just about got over the PTSD of Edinburgh Fringe Festival now. It's taken me a couple of months to...
Was it your first
to
one?
Re-acclimatise. Yes, first full Fringe.
Had you been there as a... By the way, my listeners have not gone into your story yet, so this is a bit random, but I don't care. I like doing it out of sequence. So have you gone there as a punter before you went there as a performer?
Yes, and it just inspired me. I really wanted to do it, but I never thought it could be something for me. I've been a comedy fan for my whole life. I used to listen to comedy shows like other people listen to albums. Like, I'm pretty sure I could do the whole of Eddie Izzard's Circle, word for word, inflection for inflection. If they were ever sick and they needed a reserve, I'd be there. I was ready.
I had mates who used to do that years ago, and bearing in mind how old I am, that some of them would have it on, like, cassettes or vinyl. I mean, I remember people listening to comedy on vinyl. I think one of my friends might have had Jasper Carrot on vinyl. I mean, that's really weird. But I do remember the big ones when we were kids were things like Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin and stuff like that, where people would listen to them over and over again. Mainly their stand-up shows, though. That was what it was. What got you into comedy in the first? Not now, but what got you into listening to comedy?
I think my parents were big comedy fans, proper sort of sitcom style stuff. So the old, like, Gimme, 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 The Fast Show, Harry Enfields. They were my Friday night staples when I used to watch TV with my parents. So it's always been sort of a part of my life. I can't tell you which one of my parents is the comedy fan. My mum is, well, she texts me a couple of weeks ago, I was like, oh my God, Peter Kay's touring again. I love him. He's my favourite comedian. And I took that quite personally, as you can
see. Comedy's moved so quickly, though, hasn't it? It's always evolving, but it is moving very rapidly at the moment. The stuff that we used to call alternative now is, I'm not sure, you know, some of it's a bit dated. It doesn't seem to be able to exist in the modern world, does it? It seems to have moved on. Are you conscious of that?
I don't know, really. I think change is pretty good, but you look at, because they did Friday Night Live, they brought it back and Ben Elton hosted it again. And I think it still very much had the spirit of Friday Night Live from like decades ago. But with some modern twist to it. I guess the way that people access comedy is completely different now as well. You used to be shown what you liked. There were about five or six comedians working that everybody knew. Because you saw them on one of your three or four channels. They were the comedians. Whereas now people are curating their own entertainment schedules. So some people entirely watch comedy on TikTok. Some people watch it on YouTube. People can watch it in their own time. There's enough Netflix specials to pretty much watch comedy 24 hours a day if you want to. There's so much more choice. I think it's harder to be as established as people were back in the day. But with that comes opportunity. And with that, I think... fresh new voices that you otherwise wouldn't have heard, because that is something that Edinburgh's still got a massive problem with. It is still very straight, very white, very middle class from an acts point of view. And
is it?
Yeah. So
hold that thought just there, because I'll come back to that, because the bit that I thought was the best of Friday Night Live, and I actually, do you know what? I didn't know it was on. This is the problem. I work at Channel 4 and I didn't know it was on.
Oh, you could have been there.
And this is so bizarre that it's like I was just flicking through social media again. Why, you know, I think we all want social media to die because we think we'd all be happier, but also it's very useful as well. And I was flicking through it and it was like Friday Night Live's on. So I put it on and I was watching Ben Elton. It was towards the end. And the best thing was the woman with the penis at the end who was playing the piano. Not only did I laugh out loud because she was funny, I was just thinking, this is what Channel 4 used to be. And yeah. She was running around with a penis wobbling around like that. And I was just like laughing, going, this is funny because it's different. And it's sort of, in the nice possible way, it sort of shocked me because I wasn't expecting it, because TV is very benign now.
Yeah.
That to actually see something like that was like, shit, did they know that? Has it got through the lawyers? I mean, it's been a long time
It was all ropes and pulleys, because that is Jordan Gray, who I lived with at Edinburgh Fringe. We shared this tiny studio flat where she went from being basically the South End comedian on the circuit to this stratospheric phenomenon.
Oh, your mates.
Yeah, we lived in this tiny space.
God, you've
in
got
Edinburgh.
To tell her how brilliant I thought that was. I don't think we've seen a moment on TV like that for a very long time. And I think it was very special.
But it was a huge decision for her to make. She didn't hesitate to make it because obviously the conversation that opened up, a lot of people were like you, they were surprised by it, but ultimately it is just a human body. And when you get used to it, it's you acclimatize very quickly and it feels radical and necessary, but the hate it opened up was horrific.
People, yeah, but I always
fear anything that's a little bit different, a little bit outside their comfort zone. And so
I
was proud of her, but I was also, as a friend, very much like, oh no, please
don't.
You
have to understand why people hate those, because it's because of fear. They don't understand. What I found wonderful about it was the fact that and I always say this, you know, when people are trying to change the world, and I'm sure she was just trying to entertain, not change the world, and she did entertain me, but when people are trying to change the world, if they pick up a megaphone or start writing like long things in the paper or something like that, or long threads on social media, everyone's like, oh, shut the fuck up, who cares? If you do it via art, which is comedy, film, music, painting, whatever, it makes much more of an impact. So by me seeing Jordan do that, I was like, she's brilliant. She's funny and talented. And
her whole show, it's the most perfect hour as well. And it builds to that point. That song is the finale of the show. And that's the big reveal, as it were.
For anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about here or what we're talking about here, and please, my language might be clumsy, because so excuse me if I say the wrong things, but she was dressed as a woman, she is a woman, so she was dressed and you see a woman and she's playing the piano and singing a funny song, and then at the end she gets up and she takes all her clothes off and she's got a penis, and then she's running around, but what she's doing with her penis is very funny because it's like part of the act, and she's,
it's not,
you know,
sexual either.
It's just a presentation
of a body, but that's weird that that's become shocking, because Channel 4 after 9 o'clock used to be kind of synonymous in that.
That's
or
right.
You think about Naked Attraction as well. Like, come on.
Yeah, but that's why
we're not scared of appendages.
That's why she was funny, because she wasn't making it sexual. She was making her app stupid and a bit silly. And so it's like there's a penis just on telly, you know, like windmilling around.
Of course
and
there
it's
is.
Like,
why not?
And that's what was funny. So let's get back to you. Tell her I loved that, by the way. Tell her it was a big moment for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But then back to you. So you're a punter going. We're going to get into your history, how you got there. But you're a punter going into watch the comedy, and you think, I want to do this. What is it like to cross over and actually become a performer there? Then is it? How does that feel?
It was unbelievable. So I never saw myself doing it, mainly because I was phobic of public speaking. So I used to be a proper show off. I was like the kind of child that parents think are amazing, but neighbours and family and friends would avoid in the street in case I gave them a little song and dance review and charged them a quid for it. Like, I was that child. And I don't know what happened. I don't know when it stopped. Like, nothing, because I've kind of rummaged back looking for some moment where I had like a humiliating thing happened, like my trousers fell down or I stumbled over something. So I don't know if it's just something a bit deeper, but I just became really anxious about having to speak in public on anything. And then that got bigger and bigger and bigger until it was, even if I was in front of five or six people, I'd sort of physically respond, my leg would be shaking, my eyebrow would be twitching, I'd have white noise in my head. And it just, yeah, I found it so frustrating because I work in PR, which obviously, you know, on a one-to-one basis, I seem quite confident. You'd never know. So people always thought it was a bit of a scam when I said I didn't want to public speak. They were like, you're very confident, do it. But just some switch in my head was...
I mean, look, I'm not an expert on this, but I think it's age. And with age comes an unbelievable thing where you start losing your immaturity and you start spending a lot of time looking in the mirror. And then you start thinking people are judging you. And they're not, really. They are, but they don't give a damn. You know, no one gives a damn about anyone, really, no. Apart from your children and your family, whatever. But people start, and so you start believing the world. It's like, right, I tell you what I think it's a bit like. It's like being on social media at the moment, right? If you're, say, on TV or whatever, and you put something out there. Now, when you first started, it was all very innocent. Now you're being judged on every word you put out there. So someone like me doesn't bother putting anything out there unless I'm putting promo out. I don't have an opinion. If you look to me, you think, God, Tim is the most benign man on telly, because I won't put any opinions on it, because I just don't see the point, and you get judged by them all. And I think that's what happens, because I'm the same as you. I really am. And my problem with, you know, I'm really interested in your story, because I hate doing, speaking in front of people. I love doing TV. I love doing radio. I love doing podcasting, anything like this. I adore. But as soon as I'm in front of people, it's like, I think they've got expectations for me to be funny. And just to conjure up funny like a comedian does, like you can do and like other people do, takes a lot of work, and I don't have the confidence to do that. My comedy comes from playing off other people and ad-libbing, so, you know, I'm unable to do it.
You'd be surprised, though. You'd be surprised about the different approaches to comedy in terms of just being expected to be funny on demand, because I've got a comedy panel show podcast, and I book people for that, and I need three people, and they have to, on the spot, come up with anecdotes based on a theme. Some people are absolutely brilliant at it, and some people, they want to prepare. They want the categories in advance. They've written things down, and they just can't stray from what they've scripted or what they know. And that was a real surprise to me, because I just assumed every comedian was the pub raconteur, you know, the one that you know, the mate of yours that's always got a story to tell, and everybody's listening, everybody's laughing. But
I can tell you they're not, Vix. A lot of them need socially awkward comedians. A lot of them need some prep. I went on one of those shows once. It was a pilot for something, and they booked me. It was such a bad booking. I said, I'll come, but I'm not going to do comedy. Because I don't do comedy. I do light-hearted stuff, but I won't do comedy. And then they sat me in a room before and went, here are the writers to write your lines. And I went, no, I'm not going out there to do that. That's just not me. And so I went out there and I hardly made the edit, because I was just like, I don't want to, you know, when you ever sit and watch a TV show and a celebrity comes up with a gag, it'd be written generally by somebody in a room going, here's a gag for you, you know, and then you watch them deliver it, and it's quite painful. So, but a lot of comedians want that writer's room, don't they, before they go on to anything, that's not bad. They just know what they're doing, you know. So it's right. I always find it funny when I'm doing Sunday brunch as well, my idea for comedians is they should be funny because they're on the show, and so I try and help them as much as possible. And sometimes because I sort of play the straight man a lot, just to give them some lines, so I'm feeding them lines constantly. And you get old pros and they love it, and they're like, thanks. And some of the other ones, you're like trying to give them a line, going like, I'm giving you some material here, this is your chance, this chance. And they're like, how much can I signpost this? This is your bit to ad lib, you know. It's like,
that in the show, because I did Comedy Arcade as a live show for Edinburgh Fringe, like a full run, 24 days. Did not occur to me at the time that 11:20 p.m. the comedians you book are tired. And how they feel and how they behave depends on the day they've had. So if they've had a dead day at the office, they're coming to you in a bad mood. Mm. I was sharing so much with audiences to fill space. I was digging deep. I was telling humiliating stories about me from school. I was humiliating my family. I was dragging it all out just to fill dead air.
Yeah.
Because when you're stuck, you're like, okay, the category is petty grievances, and you've got four people looking at you like they've never had a petty thought in their lives, and you know they're lying.
Yeah.
But then you have to lead from the front, don't you? So it's like, let me tell you about my petty grievance. And 28 of those. Nobody needed to hear all of that information about me.
Right, listen, I'm being
no one came twice, which
I'm being a lousy host here, because every time you're getting towards your story, I keep interrupting you. So yeah, you want to do some public speaking.
Yes, I was going to loads of conferences because I work in tech and startup. I was going to conferences and I was whinging. I was like, oh, yeah, more men, more straight white men speakers. But then I was being asked to speak and I was like, oh, no, not me. I need other women to do this. I'm too scared, which right. didn't feel quite right and in the spirit of things. So I was like, I either have to stop complaining or I have to actually do something about it. So I signed up drunkenly for a comedy course to try and get over this fear of public speaking. Always love comedy. It kind of, in that way that my Twitter algorithm is very good, it kind of presented itself in front of me exactly when I was at the moment where I needed it. I don't want to know how that works. I don't want to know if my phone's listening, but this course presented itself like the road to Oz. Signed up. Was really, really nervous about it. It was a half-day course. I was quite excited about it because it was in the Groucho, and I thought I might see some celebrities. I might humiliate myself, but
those days are gone. Groucho's not like it used to be.
Just businessmen these days.
Yeah, I know. No, there is still some scattering of people in there, but yeah, it's not like it used to be, war to war. Anyway, carry on. So you did half-day course. How'd you get on?
Yeah. I nearly bottled it as well. Right up until the day, I was like, oh, it's only like 60 quid, which is a lot, but not enough if I really physically do not want to do it. Then, as is the nature of my life, and this is why I'm really worried about Twitter going, I tweeted about it to kind of hold myself accountable.
Yeah.
So I told all the people that follow me, by the way, guys, I'm looking at doing some stand-up, going to do a course on Saturday, pray for Vix. Somebody tweeted back from Cardiff, which is my hometown, and she said, I'm traveling up to do the course as well. It'll be nice to see another Welsh girl. And because I knew there was somebody expecting me who would probably have a better time than if I was there. I know that's I'm very full of myself. I'll have a better time with me. But because somebody was using me as a kind of confidence booster, I didn't want to let them down. So I went. And we've been friends now for 3 and a bit years. And she's one of my favourite people in the world. She's a Twitch streamer now. So she did really well out of it. But...
There's something amazing, isn't there? There's something brilliant about trying to do something that makes you feel uncomfortable. And I try and put myself in that position every now and then. And then I hate myself for doing it. But then every now and then it's worth doing. The one I remember vividly, because I was so close to pulling out, was I decided to put myself on a braiding course to braid hair. Because I've got three daughters, and when the little one came along, I thought, well, why don't I learn? I have to do their hair anyway. You know, I'm a single dad, so I thought, well, I'll go in and learn how to do that. And just fascinating to do it, rather than, it wasn't because I'm this amazing dad who's, I was like, just learn how to do her hair, why not? And so, and when I was at the door to go in, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? This is gonna be so embarrassing. And I walked in, and it was just like a load of women there and me, and it felt brilliant when I walked through that door. It's an amazing feeling when you can be bothered to do it, because everyone's nice to you, aren't they? You know,
and it's bad though, isn't it, that you come away from something like that and it's so huge and it shifts something in your brain and you feel really excited about it, but ultimately you get outside and nothing has changed and you start talking about it and you realize it's only really a big deal for you. So I came out of this comedy course, I was like, I'm changed, I'm a changed woman, I can do this.
But let me pause you there. What did you learn? Because it seems to me that all my mates have done a comedy course, they all stand up and the first thing they say is, I know what you're thinking, I look like a drunk, da, da, da. I look like a crap Darren Day, I look like a bored, and that's the first thing they're always taught to do.
That is a commonly taught trick
to take the piss out of yourself. Yeah, first thing to do, a bit of self-deprecation, get you on my side, you know, oh, I know what you're thinking.
This was a women's course, so I think the vibe was very different, because we will default to self-deprecation anyway, so they kind of moved us away from that. We did this task, and it sounds really simple, but this is the thing that sort of shifted my brain. We had to all go around and talk about one thing that people in the group would never guess about you. So, which sounds a bit icebreakery, but some people really lent into it. They were like, oh, I'm looking for my adopted mother, I'm trying to have a family. Mine was
holy shit, that's comedy.
I know, and this is the thing, like, mine was, I used to have a cardboard cutout of Whoopi Goldberg dressed as Dolores Van Cartier from Sister Act in my bedroom. That was mine.
That's good.
I was just mortified to have to say that, having had people properly share in the circle. But fortunately, Jen Smith, who is my friend that I'm still friends with, hers was that she got gunged on like Parents Get Lost, that TV show back in the 90s. So I was like, you're a keeper. You're my soulmate. Don't know what these people are about. But then the course leader went back around and she said, okay, now you have got to remember everything you can about the person that spoke before you.
And none of
us had listened to anything that anyone else had said because we were all so focused on the fact that we were having to say our bit. And she'd specifically said, don't prepare, literally just say what comes into your head, because I could not remember a shred of the woman next to me's thing. And it was really, really interesting. She was like, if you'd been listening to that woman, you wouldn't have had time to get yourself in a state, and you actually would have had a much better time over the last 20 minutes. And that really resonated with me. And it made me think of how many meetings and how many things that I've gone to and forced myself to speak and just not taken in a word of anything else, because I was
The teaching of the Stoics they're doing there. That's not comedy. That's be in the present. But Zen going on.
But
anyway,
that was the start of it. Because if you're sort of living in the moment, you haven't really got time to get yourself into a lather about whether or not you're going to fall over, fall through a trapdoor, or whatever. I don't even know what my brain was conjuring as the worst case scenario. It was a pure physical response. I could be on my slides, fully prepared, and I'd still be acting like I was on the edge of a stroke. But didn't cure me, but I did get a bit of a taste for it, because I was making people laugh in the little bit where you go around and you do your little laughy bit. And so I tweeted about it again, because this is my life. My life is Twitter. We must keep it. It must stay. And the comedian Mark Watson saw my tweets, saying, does anyone know how you can get into open micing?
How do you know him?
Just pure like serendipity, basically. I'd got involved in a conversation that he and Katie Brand were having months before. It sounds really convoluted. About making up films with common tropes. So they were like, oh, I'm a PR person that's really glossy, and I'm going to have to go to a far-flung Scottish island where I'll be too glossy for the village, and I'll fall in love with a local grumpy man who secretly is the love of my life. And I joined in because I was like, that's my job and it's all true. And then they both started following me back, and I was like, this is the best day of my life. A few months later, Mark saw my tweet and invited me to be on his 26-hour marathon show and get over my fear once and for all with him learning stand-up. So that's how everyone gets in. It's a boring story, really.
Really boring. No, that's a brilliant, cliche, boring story. Matt Watson's lovely, by the way. Such a lovely bloke.
He did not realise 4 years ago when he did that he was going to be stuck with me for the rest of his life.
Right, okay.
I literally made him open one of my shows in Edinburgh because I wanted to know what it would feel like with people in the room. I was like, please. My flyerer couldn't sell it either. She was flyering going, oh, Vic Slayton's show, and Mark Watson's going to do a 10-minute set at the start. And they were like, yeah, right. And then what's going to happen? The Queen's going to come and James Acaster will be there. It's like, so... But he actually did. It's probably the smallest gig he's done in about 20 years.
Oh, that's great. So what was he doing, though, 36 hours? Did he say 36 or 26?
26, which is still quite a lot.
That is. That's over a day in my calculations. Where was he doing this? I remember it, but I can't remember where he did it. Where did he do it?
The Pleasance in London. So...
But was it broadcast streamed or something? Or was it just audio?
He did one for Comic Relief either Comic Relief or Children in Need that was televised. This one was live streamed on Twitch before Twitch was really a thing, actually.
Right.
So the footage is still knocking about with me looking like a deer in headlights. At one point, I was like, my lips are stuck to my teeth and they're never going to unglue. Like, I was having that kind of moment.
Were you funny? Was there an audience there?
Yeah, so there were about 100 of us, and we all stayed pretty much for the full 26 hours. So it was feral by the end.
Were you funny?
He's got this way. He's not just a comedian. He's like,
he
could be a cult leader if he ever went evil. Like, if he went dark side, he'd be very compelling. But as it is, he uses his powers for good. So basically, a lot of people in the room were given challenges. Some of them were really silly, like, I'm going to be on exercise bike for 26 hours. Someone was doing, like, countdown conundrums for 26 hours. A comedian did all of the songs of the Beatles. There was someone next to me who was just writing lines. I think they really dropped the ball on that task in terms of attention, because it was not compelling and it really got mentioned. But
what were you doing, Vix?
Comedy. So I was being dragged up every hour or so and sent off on a little mission with somebody in the room. So I did some confidence training. The comedian Lulu Popplewell took me away and taught me a little bit about generating material. Ian Stone did a storytelling thing live on stage, which was probably the most surreal moment of my life. It was 5 a.m. Ian Stone was there. Mark Watson was there. Sophie Hagen was behind a desk. Jade Adams and Rich Wilson were in the audience. And I was talking about, I think, Westlife.
So how long did it take after that? How long did it take before you were ready to go on a stage and do a show on yourself? Or were you continue doing open mics and things?
So my time there, I met a guy called Tom Tuck who ran his own comedy night, and he DM'd me a week later and said, do you want to come and do your first proper gig with us? Are you ready? So I went and did my gig with him. And that just started me off. And they were so, so nice about my very mediocre set that I got an idea in my head that I might be good at it. And it kind of escalated from there, really.
So how is your public speaking now? Obviously, when you go on stage, there's two different things. There's public speaking, which is one thing, standing up in front of a room. And there's another thing where now you've added to it that you now have to make them laugh as well, which is another task in itself. So first of all, are you very comfortable standing in front of a room now?
Yeah. I love public speaking now because you don't have to make people laugh. It's an absolute dream. It's like, let me present these dry slides. I love it. Hook it to my veins.
Yeah. And what about making them laugh? Does that get you nervous now, or are you just fine with that as well?
It's weird because at the start I was so unbelievably excited that I was doing it because it was out of the realms of possibility. I would have backed myself as a skydiver before I do comedy, that it didn't really matter about the audience response because I had all these endorphins from just standing there, feeling on the edge of a cliff and getting through it. I didn't really care about the quality. So I sort of banged through. I'm quite a petty person. So I met a comedy promoter, open mic guy, who told me that you couldn't call yourself a comedian until you'd done 100 gigs. So to prove a point to him, even though I didn't tell him I was proving a point to him and he still doesn't know that I've done it, I did 100 gigs in a year. And I was like, ha, that'll show you.
Right. That's brilliant.
I think. But yeah.
So what would you say to somebody is the key of doing public appearances? What is one of the things that can get you comfortable standing up and talking in front of people?
Everybody expects you to do well, and nobody is waiting for you to flounder. Like, I can't remember a single time where someone's like fluffed a line or done something at a talk that maybe they hadn't expected. I can't even summon one to mind. Like, everybody is rooting for you in the room. Nobody's waiting for you to cock it up. And I think I was of the opinion, I think we sort of touched on it earlier, that everybody was waiting for me to, everybody was looking at me with a critical eye, but ultimately no one cares, particularly in a conference, no one cares. But also nobody knows what you've got written down. So if you've planned 30 slides meticulously and you end up going on in a completely different direction, unless you give it away, no one knows. Mm. Nobody knows what you're meant to say. It's fun with jokes as well, because sometimes you'll sort of be waiting at the punchline for people to laugh, and they don't. And as long as you game face it, you can just pretend it was never meant to happen. You're just like, yeah, this is just a setup to another thing. Or one person will laugh and you'll be like, that one was just for you. I've got one for everyone. We'll get to you all at the end. But no one knows. Nobody knows where the punchline's supposed to be. So you can pretty much wing it. But yeah, it's quite liberating.
I had Russell Cain on this podcast, and I asked him, give me one great tip for comedy. And his tip is actually stay with me a lot. I do love it. He said, always look to the back of the room because then you bring everybody in. And I watch great comedians now, and you see the first thing they do, and I think they do it naturally, they walk out and they look right to the back of the room. As soon as you look at the back of the room, you're talking to everyone. And you're bringing people in. And it's funny because I used to do the hosting of the Teenage Cancer Trust at the Royal Albert Hall. And it's very, very easy.
That's a big old gig.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. It was really good. It was good. It was great fun. And also great charity, great cause. And yeah, there's some amazing things happen there as well. So I saw some great acts and stuff. But what a lot of people do is, what I want to do is, the tempted to do is look down at the front row because they're the ones closest to you. They're the ones you see. But as soon as you look at the front row, you've just discounted everybody else, and you can see people do it, and it's such an awkward thing to do. And so that was the first thing that I learned. And then the second thing I learned, which was the most important lesson you can have with any form of public speaking, is owning the time. And I remember being at the Mercury Awards, listen to me just name dropping shit all over the place, but the Mercury Awards, all the bands, right, I went to loads of them, and what they do is it's very time constrained, and then the presenter, whoever it is, Joe Wiley, whoever, will go, and here's blah, you know, and they'll say the band, and then the band start playing, and that's what they have to do immediately, they have to start playing. Because we were all industry people, I was, you know, doing radio and stuff in those days, and Channel 4, we had it there. We're all industry people, so we don't care because we're knobs. So we're all just having our dinner and chatting all the way through their acts. Yeah. We don't give a fuck, you know, they don't care that you're doing it because I've seen a million things. I'm so cool and trendy. Anyway, Damon Albarn comes out, sits there with his guitar. I think he might have been doing a solo thing. I can't remember now. Well, definitely wasn't Gorillaz or Blur. And he sits there, and he owns the time. He refused to do anything until the room had... And it was just the most powerful thing I'd seen, as everybody went, hold on a second, he's not playing. Why is he not playing? He's just sort of sat there, and he was looking all around the room, at the back of the room and everything. And then when the room had hushed, he went, started playing, his guitar started, and he started playing, and the bloke I was with turned to me, one of the heads of the labels turned to me and said, that is how you work a room. And I just thought, that is absolutely fucking brilliant, you know what I mean? And no one said anything through his performance.
That's so cool. I've seen comedians turn a room like that, and it is spectacular to watch.
You have to have balls to stand up there and do nothing.
Just to wait. It goes against every human instinct to be like, it's your own time you're wasting. Russell Kane's amazing, though. I once DM'd him. I got him on my podcast. I DM'd him boldly, even though we'd never met before, and told him that my first ever ex-boyfriend's friend was coming on, and I wanted him to feed back to him that I was doing well. So with that in mind, would he be prepared to come on, because he was such a big deal? And he did it.
Oh, that's amazing. Brilliant.
He read my message and he came on, absolutely nailed it.
He's a lovely guy. He really is. But he's one of those ones. He works hard. He does not stop working. He wants to exercise that comedy muscle all the time. And
we talked about it. Just after we'd stopped recording, and it wasn't really in the spirit of the show, but I kind of wish I still had it, because I remember him saying that when you're working class and you come from a background like we do, you work a little bit harder for it. So he was talking about how he did Let's Dance for Comic Relief, and everybody else has done a stripped down version of their routines to, you know, make it easier. And he was committed to doing every Beyonce move, move for move. Yeah. And it resonated so much with me. He's such an interesting man, but so, so lovely.
He believes you have to tour constantly. Never take a week off, because you lose like exercising. If you stop doing it, you'll start losing the muscle. So it's comedy muscle. If anyone's interested, I did a podcast with him a few years ago, and it's fantastic. Just look through my back catalogue. Really interesting. He gives lots of advice if you want to become a comedian, and tips of how he did it and things he does. So what part you do? A numerous amount of podcasts, don't you? How many do you do?
Well, Comedy Arcade, the panel show, is on a bit of a recording hiatus at the moment, because trying to get four comedians together to record is a lot more difficult when you're not in a lockdown situation and they're not busy. Yeah, it's funny how that happens. But it was quite labor intensive to keep doing it week after week and sort of coordinating that amount of people. And it's kind of evolved into a live show now. So I did the full run at Edinburgh with it, fell in love with it as a live show concept. And I think the audience make it, because it's just it's a really different vibe with the audience. I'm keeping it on as a live experience, because that's what I'm known for. And I can get onto bills and festivals with that my name alone will not carry. So I'm not letting that go for a little while. But I've got a new podcast now called False Economy with Mark Watson's brother Paul. And the conceit is that Paul is the little middle aisle version of Mark Watson, because it's all about value and spending money. It's like, we could have had Mark Watson, but we've got someone who looks like him and sounds like him, but is a lot cheaper and more available. It's Paul. But I love Paul in a separate way.
Paul's a writer, isn't he?
Yeah, sports journalist, writer, but he is fascinating. Like, I'm constantly in awe of people and their bravery and their ability to do absurd things that I could only dream of. He decided he wanted to be the youngest ever international football player. So him and his friend looked for the worst team in the world, because they knew they couldn't qualify for UK teams. Yeah. So they found the worst team in the world over in Pompeii, got in touch with them about becoming players for them, realized that they'd need to like take a wife or live there for a few years to qualify. But over the course of them getting in touch, it manifested that they were looking for a football coach. So he moved halfway across the world with his friend to coach the world's worst football team. So he's technically like the world's youngest international football manager. It's
That's brilliant.
He's really settled now. He lives in Gloucester with his wife and two kids, but it's such a rogue decision. Like, I'm fascinated by the mentality to take a year out of your life, spend all your money on a team that is playing in like a car park full of potholes.
Yeah, but he's a Bristol City fan, isn't he? So he's used to that
he's
sort
used
of crap.
To but he's really passionate about like including countries, I guess it's topical now, including countries that don't qualify for FIFA or don't want to be part of FIFA and bringing them into global football. It's very cool. And
you're working in financial PR, and the podcast is about that, really. It's about finances. I listened to the one with Nick Hancock, actually. It's good stuff. He's a nice bloke, isn't he? So you've got a background in PR, financial PR, but you're still working in it, is that right?
Yes. So I've worked in pretty much every money saving website you can imagine: voucher codes, Quidco, Money Supermarket, Confused.com. Being like the kind of front woman spokesperson. And I just really enjoyed it. I got into it by accident because my lofty ambition was to do PR for music. That's what I wanted. Yeah. That was my dream. Or A&R stuff. Like, I had this idea that I was going to discover the next big band. So wow. I worked towards that for a few years. Botched an interview for the record label BMG when I was 19 by getting into an argument with the interviewer about the rock credentials of Avril Lavigne.
Right, okay.
My dad drove me all the way up to London for this final interview for this dream internship that would have changed my life. She asked me to write a press release for Avril Lavigne that was geared towards Kerrang. And I was like a rock club devotee at the time. And I just absolutely rinsed her. And I was having like an out-of-body experience with it. I could see myself arguing with the interviewer, but I couldn't stop myself. The person floating above me could not intervene. So I didn't end up writing that press release. She was like, do you know what? I think I've heard enough. I was like, no, I'll do it. And she's like, no. So I think I was in there for 15 minutes. The 4-hour drive back was pretty brutal.
Though, if you'd got that job, you might be just, because it's a good job, you might just be working in the music industry. Nothing wrong with that, but that wouldn't have got you to do meet Mark Watson, do stand up and take this. So, you know, you've got to look at it like that, I suppose.
Funny enough, though, I met somebody when I was working in public sector who had done that internship, possibly not the same year as me. It would be really weird if she got the job that I didn't get. But I cannot express enough how she was working in the public sector with me. So maybe it wouldn't have changed my life. I found that quite comforting.
Right. Okay. Okay. So when you're doing these, can you, to get onto your day job, because I think our listeners, my listeners would like to hear this. Can you actually save money? Can you be a better shopper? Is there ways of getting deals? I'm so bad at it because I've got no patience and I can't bother to research. So I just sort of, the way I look at it is I read a book once on the choice paradox. I've talked about this on the show lots of times. And it said, if you're looking for the best of everything, you're always going to be disappointed. If you just look for okay and you're satisfied with something, you'll be fine. So with the price, I always go, am I all right with that? Yeah, fine, I'll pay it, right? And I don't spend hours looking around for stuff. But am I mad? Is there good deals out there that I'm missing out on?
It's funny you should say that. Rory Sutherland, who's a big marketeer, talks about that in relation to McDonald's. And he's like, the reason that people go to McDonald's is for that reason. They know exactly what they get and the price they're going to pay for it. So they could try somewhere else and be disappointed, or just go straight down the middle, and that's the entire success of the McDonald's model. But yeah, you can see why, because I guess I'm at Hot UK Deals now, and it's a consumer money saving forum. So loads and loads of people just find deals and just post about them, and then everyone votes on whether or not it's exciting enough. And some of them are really like, oh, this Asda in Coryton outside Cardiff has got 10p Cadbury's cream eggs, which is brilliant if you live locally. But there are some huge savings to be made. And the thing is, on big stuff as well. So if you're buying a new TV or if you're buying a suite or anything, it's well worth having a little compare because there's always something on that will get it for you cheaper, whether you're signing up for a website with 10% discount or even if it's like free postage and packaging, which takes £8 off. There are always these little hacks that are worth it because I'm very much of the – I hate those articles where people say – don't get your Starbucks in the morning and make a coffee at home because it's not the same. Like, yeah. There are things that I want to spend money on because I get a lot of joy out of life. And I know there are ways to save so much more money than I do, but I'm lucky enough to be on a wage where I won't die if I go for the Starbucks. And I think people like us, we've got loads more money we could save. And this is what's so horrible about the cost of living crisis at the moment. The people that are suffering the most are already doing all this. And that's what's frustrating because I'm being asked to comment to press all the time about, okay, how can we bring down the cost of energy prices or how can people shop around for that? And like the people that really need it, they are already doing that. They're meticulous with it and they're brilliant people that are coming to the website and they're sharing these tips. So they'll be like, oh, this fixed rate is on and it's for 24 months, not 12. Or they are all over it and they want to share that information with people. But in terms of sort of household bills, it's reaching a point where I hate to say it, there's not a lot of advice I can give, but things like train tickets, absolutely. There is loads of margin and stuff like that. Freebies as well.
Oh, go on, go back to train tickets because people are doing a lot of traveling at the moment, especially with Christmas coming up if there's no strikes. But what happens with train tickets? What do we need to do?
Get in there early if you can. That's the best advice. So they usually release them 3 months in advance. So as soon as my Christmas tickets were coming, I was there. I was up for it.
Right.
But also, use the one thing that people don't do because everyone moans about trains being delayed and late and cancelled. A lot of people don't bother to claim the money back because they think it would be really complicated. Like the delay repay system, I've used every single one of them. It is a single form. They back some money to your bank. It's usually within days. They say give it 2 weeks. I think it's never been more than a few days for me. I'm doing it on the train. It ticks over to 15 minutes late and I'm on the delay repay getting my money back.
Really?
Yeah. But yeah, it's that's the kind of stuff that I always remember to do because
wow, that's really
I never
good,
did it before.
Yeah.
I'm a haggler as well. I'm also somebody though, which is an unusual trait in people. I will ask for money back at a restaurant if I don't like the meal. Like I'm that person. I will complain. When they're like, how is this? I'm like, there's not enough fish in this batter actually. And yeah, I was out for lunch with a friend and I thought he would have rather paid £30 more himself, I think, than watch me critique the fish from the fish and chips I had. And I wouldn't mind, but we went in a Wetherspoons, we were in quite a fancy place and it was like £25. And I think if you're paying £25, I'd rather speak up so they maybe buck their game up than have somebody else go there who's got £25 and it's a treat. And they're not speaking up. So I feel like I'm kind of talking for everyone. That's how I justify my horrible, petty behaviour.
I don't know whether I should say this to people, but I used to work in a restaurant. I've worked in many restaurants and bars. And I used to say to the customers often, I'd say, if I was you, I would ask for your money back on that meal because it looks disgusting or it looks terrible. It's not good enough. And I'd say I wouldn't accept it. And I know for a fact that the restaurant will give this restaurant's doing all right. It's making money. I said, the least you're going to get is free drinks here. You might get free dessert. You might get the whole bill paid for you, but I wouldn't accept it. Shall I get the manager over? And they go, really? And I say, eat it. But I wouldn't accept it because it just doesn't look good. And I'll back you up. Because sometimes you'd be in a restaurant and the kitchen would go down. It's not the customer's fault. It was going down because they hadn't staffed it properly or something like that. And I'd get my tips up by doing that as well.
But they'll give you the difference they weren't expecting to make the same.
I wasn't a team player on that thing. Like I was always good in the team. I was always like, Jesus Christ, they're paying a lot of money for this. And sometimes the crap I'd see come out of the kitchen. And then I'd be like, you know, they're paying how much for that? That's just that it doesn't look like what it should look like, you know. And I was used to it, so yeah. So yeah, it's not bad.
That is exactly what happened to me, though. Like that is literally like I called the waitress came over and said, "Oh, how was your meal?" And I was like, I G'd myself up for it. I was like, yeah, the thing is, there wasn't really any fish in there. It was just mainly like a batter envelope. And she said, okay, I'll go and speak to the chef. And then we asked for the bill and there had been no change on it. And again, my friend was like kicking me under the table. He was like semaphoring with his eyes, like, please, no. And because I said to him, I bet we'll get off to coffee or a Prosecco or a dessert or something. It'll be, you know, and it'll be worth your excruciating embarrassment. And so she brought the bill and then she said, I said, what happened with the fish? And she said, oh, the chef said it was just the end of the fish. And so I was like, why is that my problem? And she was quite confrontational. She's like, oh, what do you want to do about it? I was like, well, I want it taken off the bill.
Yeah.
Or something else. And I got it for free. And I was like,
that's good. I had a good one the other day, though. I'd spent a bit of money on this meal, but I'd ordered something called red mullet. And I'd never had red mullet before. And I've never had it again.
Is that a bony fish?
No, it just tastes like it's been hanging out in a sewers. I spoke to Simon Rimmer of my show, and he said, yeah, I think it's a bottom dweller or something, and just eats crap. But it tasted like it had just been in a sewer, right? I just hated it. And it was in batter as well, so it was supposed to be delicious and everything. And so I just like took two bites of it, really tried my hardest, and just like I didn't like it. And then I felt embarrassed. And then what happened was the waiter came over and she said, or waitress, I don't, a server. What do we call people these days?
I don't know. Do you know what? I questioned that. I wasn't sure I said it. And I was like, oh no, is this a cancelable offence?
I don't know what it is. Anyway, the lady came over and said, is everything all right with your fish? I said, I don't know. I assume it's fine. It just tastes horrible to me. And they were like, oh, okay. And then they said, we've taken it off the bill. I said, well, you don't have to do that actually, because it was me who didn't like it. I'm sure it was cooked fine. And they're like, no. If you don't like it, we can't get you pay for it. You didn't eat it. And I thought, that is so lovely of them to do that. I don't know if anyone wants to let me know what mullet is, because it's not. No, I'm never having it again. I really like fish, but I'm never having it again. It was just not good taste. Now, someone tells me that if you, when you're trying to buy your Christmas shopping now, someone told me not to. Right, two things. First thing, if you've got a contract coming up with anything, someone told me never ever sign your contract. Start again as a new customer, because you'll get a better discount as a new customer than you ever will as an existing customer. So make sure every contract, you know when it's up, and then cancel it and start again. You get discounts. Yeah. Is that true?
Technically, yes. It's getting, they're not as good as they used to be, because they know people are onto them now, because they used to be able to rely on these dormant customers that are just paying the same or maybe slightly more all year, and then that would feed the funnel of bringing in new customers with highly discounted rates. But right. People have got into the habit of shopping around now, and because everybody's a little bit more discerning, the discounts aren't quite as deep. Okay. So you need to sort of dig into your new member offers just to make sure they actually are worth the time. And obviously there is the argument of, you know, when you ring up the cancellations line, it's really the retentions line. So they are going to really try very hard to keep you on the hook. But that's not a bad thing. Like, that's not a bad aim point. If you go in with the idea that you want to cancel, a lot of the time the retentions team will have a lot of discount they can give you to stop you going elsewhere. So it's one of those things where
it's just a
the
nightmare
maximum to... saving is to jump, probably, but you get a saving and still you take no further action than this call, you can still get a saving. Make that call.
But it's a call.
I know, and that's what puts everybody off. That's why they make it a call.
Yeah, because the call
so
is like painful.
So I'm paying for my Times subscription, even though I don't read it. I can't bear to ring up.
So yeah, do you have to ring up for that one? I just cancel.
Yeah, otherwise they just hound you. They start ringing you up.
I
cancelled the direct debit thinking I was very clever, and then they just hounded me.
Did they? Yeah. See, I hate that as well. If you don't want a product, that you should be able to get off. And so the other one that people tell me to do is, if you want to buy something, right, you're buying someone a Christmas present. Vix, I'm buying you a Christmas present. I'm going to buy you a Black and Decker Workmate, whatever that is, but that's what they used
How
to
did
advertise
you know?
Years ago. Is that what you wanted? Yeah. So I'm buying you one of those. But rather than buy it, what I'm going to do is this. I've got two little techniques. The first one is, I'm going to go to Amazon or one of those sites, and I'm going to stick it in my basket, but not buy it. And the second one I'm going to do is, I'm going to say into my phone or around my phone and computer, I would like to buy the Black & Decker Workmate if only it was discounted a bit. Are either of those true, that then they come back with offers?
The basket one is, that's legit. Yeah, absolutely. It's always worth seeing if they'll fire a voucher code. They typically will. And even if it's only like free delivery, it saves you a couple of quid. So that is a good habit to get into.
Is that Amazon or everything?
Pretty much everything. A lot of people will, they want to seal the deal. So clothes shops are particularly good at it. And obviously you then see it chasing you around the internet. There are some places that are so constantly in sale that if you pay full price, you're a mug. It's like going to Pizza Express and paying full price. No one's ever done it. You shouldn't. There's always a voucher.
I have. Why? What should you do?
There's always a voucher for Pizza Express, even if it's some free dough balls. Hot UK deals for one, but everywhere. Google it. It's a quick Google.
So before you go anywhere, you need to Google, do I get a discount voucher?
Pretty much, I do it all the time, and I'm usually right. So the saying it into your phone, that is, I argue with people on this because I know rationally, because I work in retail, that's not supposed to happen. That doesn't happen. That's not technology. I see it happen enough that I kind of don't believe my own version of truth. But what definitely happens is if you'll go past a shop and you've been sort of loitering in the window, they've got beacon technology. So they geo-target you and they will serve you like a Ted Baker advert if you've been loitering outside Ted Baker, if you've got
what? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, right. No, rewind.
It's better than them listening to your Alexa, right?
Rewind. I mean,
it's a photo finish, but...
What does beacon technology mean?
So it's just technology that your phone knows where you are and it communicates with the technology in the shop. So it's like, Tim Lovejoy is here. He's looked in the window. He's on the hook. Send him a discount. Do it. So,
holy shit, really?
Yeah, so that's the real truth of why you walk past a shop and it's like, oh, how does it know? It's literal, it's tech.
So to use that to your advantage, really, is if you go and hang outside the Black & Decker shop to buy your Black & Decker work, mate. I don't know if there is one.
You're really committed to this, this fake present you're buying
whether you like it or not, you're getting a Black & Decker work. I do know, I'd be fascinated to know whether, because I'm talking to you via a
Black & Decker.
via my computer, and my phone's right next to me, so I'm going to be absolutely fascinated if later I'm served for the Black & Decker workmate, if they still exist.
But
Black & Decker products.
Google also reads all your emails as well. So if you've emailed somebody or in your WhatsApp, for example, if you said Black & Decker, if you texted like, oh my God, I can't believe I talked so much to you about Black & Decker drills, that is all in the back end.
Is that real that it's reading, or is that just
yeah, but it's not reading it, is it? It's not human beings like laughing like, oh my God, I can't believe you fell in a puddle. It is just looking for keywords and sort of firing ads at you.
Algorithms.
Yeah. I like a good algorithm. It's expensive, but they get me right so often. I'm like, do you know what? I do want those shoes.
Right. Okay.
It knows so, me but so it's, well. It's dangerous.
Yeah, but then that's really interesting because on life you've got to set your algorithms. So for instance, if you spend a lot of time researching is the moon landings real, you'll get moved towards QAnon eventually, and you'll get moved towards the far right and Trump and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's where you'll go. And if you spend enough time,
it's annoying because any engagement, whether it's positive or negative, does sort of skew the algorithm. Because I was arguing with transphobes about Jordan Gray, actually coming back to Jordan. So I was just going back to them, correcting the pronouns that they were using, or being ultimately useless and giving them a bigger voice than they ever had because they had two followers and I've got more. But so I had to whip myself for that. But then I started seeing loads of very transphobic content because they thought that was something I wanted to see. It's easy for them to either get it wrong, or obviously the cynical view with Twitter is they want to prompt you to act. So they don't care if you're angry about it or happy with it. They just want you to engage with it. In the same way, you'll see articles that have got a particularly scandalous title because they want people to hate click it. Like if you see an article that's like, I'm not going to name any awful writers. There are too many to choose from. But if it's somebody like, am I wrong? I was crying because my daughter had a tattoo and I feel like she's died. You know, those kind of nonsense. They don't care why you're clicking on the article, because what they sell to advertisers is the clicks. So they don't care how you engage. They just care that you engage. So if you do see an article that you're angry about, screen grab it and don't link it. Don't give them what they want.
But I wonder, I know, and I think we're all susceptible to it as well, and I think we're all in bias, and we all live in our little bubbles, and I don't think we can help it, and I think that's the problem, is you start looking at these things and you start doing it. I wonder if we should call this podcast, because I call them curious, I'm just curious how to save more money than you could ever imagine, and then I wonder if I'd do something extreme like that, and then...
And then, it's true. We are then, talking about savings you don't think you can get.
But they're more than you can ever imagine. But getting back to shopping, because I think this is really, really fascinating, because we're all aware that, and like, if you're not aware that you're looking at stuff and you're being led down that garden path, whether you're whether you're left, right, whatever, whichever way you're looking, if you don't think you're doing that, you're insane, because you're basically, as soon as you log on, or as soon as you read a paper, or as soon as you watch TV, you're taking on the thoughts of other people, and that's whether you like it or not, that's what's happening to you. But with it, when it comes to shopping, that's real, or spending money, that's a really interesting thing. You need to get the out. What I've learned from this is we need to learn how to play the algorithms, don't we?
Yeah.
So you start looking around for you start going, where's the deal? Where's the discount? Then you end up being served your website or you know, people like, you know, the confused.com. Which one do you work on at the moment?
Hot UK Deals.
Hot UK Deals.
But shopping around in general is such a good habit to have. I'm pretty. Yeah, I'm open-minded to all of them. It's just free money. Same with things like cashback. If you can get into the habit of using a cashback site, you just get a little bit of money every time you transact anywhere. That earned me thousands doing that, just getting into the habit of clicking through. Because people think cashback is too good to be true, the idea that you just get money for buying something.
Yeah.
But what they don't realize is when you're doing marketing for a product, you've got an idea in your head on how much a customer is worth. And you usually see bigger discounts on things like mobile phone contracts. For this reason, you'll see bigger cashback, because they'll go, okay, the lifetime value of this customer is this. It's like £3,000. So we're willing to pay £45 to capture this specific customer. We know they're the type that will stay with us. And that's just the money they're paying. So rather than spending that £45 on an advert or a poster or a leaflet, they'll just give it back to you to sort of lure the money conscious into making a good decision. But things like life insurance policies, I've had £200 off. I had like £800 off a holiday once. It takes a while for the money to come back to you. So you have to have it spent. Yeah, I had 10% off with Secret Escapes, and I did a Sri Lanka tour, and I think it was about £4,000 because it was a special holiday. But the more you've, and this is the annoying thing, because the more money you've got to spend, the more money you can save. And this is, like I said, this is this hateful dichotomy that I'm in at the moment, because I want to save money for the people that need it the most. But there's a whole world of people that are spending more than they need to on your big ticket items. And I want everybody to pay the best price.
It's the Phil Collins
thing. It's my life's
thing.
Mission.
Yeah, it's the Phil Collins thing. Phil Collins always said that when he was young and wanted drums and couldn't afford them, he had to, you know, beg, steal and borrow to try and get a drum set. Suddenly he's absolutely loaded with all his money, and he gets sent millions of drums constantly for free. Yeah. And it's always that way. My big dilemma with this, and it's because it's kind of hard. If I did do that as the title, Curious How to Save More Money, people go, that's really uncouth in this climate. And it is probably. And my big problem with it is there's more than enough money in the world, and there's more than enough money in Britain to go around that we don't have to do it. It's just our systems in place at the moment. I don't want to get too political. Are in place at the moment.
I'm
not doing it. And it's like, I just feel that everyone should be allowed to have a decent wage, some food to eat, and somewhere to live. You know, it's like I think we need to revisit the system soon, because it seems to be a little broken. Because you see the profits these companies are making. You know, like Amazon, for instance, which we're all talking about now and all using, their profits are they're obscene. You know, what's he doing with all that? Why can't he give it back?
Yeah, because it's funny, because I'm running a campaign at the moment to collect unwanted football shirts for kids that wouldn't be able to get them otherwise, so their parents can't afford them. And you think football clubs are so, so rich. So I was really excited the first year we did it. I was like, we're asking people to send in their kind of to rehome pre-loved shirts. But
yeah, great idea.
we were super excited. We were like, we're going to go to all the clubs and they can just give us all their old stock, or they're bound to have a few lying around. It'll be fine. No one got back to us. And they're charging like £60 to £80 for a full kit for a child.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even engage with us on giving us a discount because we were trying to buy them in bulk. And it's annoying. And I think the thing that is most disappointing is we are relying on people to take up, you know, to hold up society, to make sure everybody's looked after, you know, food banks and like apps like Olio, where you're community sharing. So if you've got a banana in your fridge that's going to go off, you can give it to your neighbour. But it's all this kind of, it's almost this make-do amend mentality, isn't it? Of,
yeah, fix the two things there. What's your charity called?
Kitmas. Yeah, kit for Christmas. Do you see what we did there?
Yeah,
it's a very
sophisticated
portmanteau.
I love it. So if you've got a kit and you don't mind getting rid of it, then you go to Kitmas and you can send it to you and you
yes. So there's a brilliant PO box. It all goes directly to my co-host of False Economy, Paul Watson's house, which is hilarious. So every year his house is just full of football kits. But
that's wonderful.
There's a crowdfunder as well. So if you haven't got any football kits but you want to donate, you can just chuck some money in. And we made £30,000 of donations last year.
Fantastic.
Which was 3,000 football shirts. And like waking up on Christmas morning, it was the most excited I've been about Christmas Day for ages. Just knowing that kids were going to be opening something that maybe they were expecting to get because Santa was going to deliver it, but the parents did not have a method to deliver it. So it's
that's
just
wonderful.
Yes.
That's absolutely
it's
wonderful.
So lovely. But
do you know my problem with Father Christmas is he means test kids. I always think this.
Yeah. And
I can't help it. Having daughters, when they go to school and they go, you know, I do okay, I'm on telly and stuff, and so they've always had nice presents, but I just feel sorry for the kids who don't, and they go to school and go, and some kid, what did you get for Christmas? I got a bike. What did you get? Oh, secondhand doll. It's like, oh, well, Santa doesn't like you then, because what?
Yeah.
It's the same Santa,
you're
isn't it?
And nice, this, you know, the notion, yeah, of like, you want the naughtiness or the niceness. It's like, well, I've got this secondhand scale X-ray, so to be honest, I'm not sure.
I find it really uncomfortable Christmas with that whole thing. I really do. I can't ever work out whether mine are too old now for it, but can never work out whether it's a Father Christmas is a good concept, or it's a concept for adults rather than for children.
I think it used to be before you could so obviously compare your life to somebody else's, because now it's the whole, I open Instagram and I am child free by choice and I love it, but a lot of my friends are, their kids are of an age now where Father Christmas is like hashtag he's been, and it's just this massive ridiculous pile of presents, and it's like, is that for your kids or is that for you? Because Elf on the Shelf was the same, hateful, like what was that about, like really elaborate scenes, and I was like, does your two-year-old know that that is an Elf on the Shelf being sick into a tiny toilet, or is this just me?
My daughter, I got her an Elf on the Shelf, and it made me laugh because it said on it, it's the great tradition from the something family in America. It's over 16 years old or something. It's like, it's hardly Dickens, is it? Do you know what I mean? It's like, just made me laugh a lot. But I used to just stick it around. But some of my mates said that like they would, the elf would be delivering every day. They'd be delivering sweets or something.
It's just another stupid thing. Well, there's Christmas Eve boxes now. That's a thing that you can buy a box with like fresh pajamas and a book and a DVD.
Yeah, what about matching pajamas for a couple of days? I mean, that is insane. People just pay all that money for matching pajamas. Well, it's for Instagram, isn't it? Apologies to all my listeners who have bought matching pajamas for Christmas.
You must throw them away now.
I think it's a great idea. Keep doing it. I always get told off because I can sort of, I get very frustrated with the commercialism and the capitalism which goes along with it, or the extreme capitalism which goes along with Christmas, and I just think it's the desire and greed which is never healthy takes over from the actual wonderful bit of Christmas, which is people having a good time and getting together, and the streets look amazing, all decorated, and the atmosphere is fantastic, and behind every front door there's some man and woman going, A, how do I afford it all? And B, what the hell does everyone want? And why am I buying them this shit? Yeah. And why do they, no one needs any of that. I wanted to, Kitmas is a good idea. I wanted to my kids laugh at me because I invented Bookmas, where everyone just buys each other a book because books are good. And my
That's
kids have,
lovely.
Well, it's backfired on me a bit because every year my twins turn up and they're 20 and they turn up with a book and go, happy Bookmas. And I'm like, oh, is that all I get? And it's usually something political. Good. So
I like that. It's lovely. But we get letters from like literal kids that have seen a campaign on TV and they're like, I want to give you this shirt because I want some.
It's wonderful.
Are fundamentally good. I think that's wonderful.
I think that's brilliant. Really good.
I want to believe that anyway.
Well, but in all the studies.
Christmas is a tricky time, but that is where you need to shop around because there are some brilliant deals available. Like you can get a full Christmas dinner now. I think it's Tesco's that say they can do a full Christmas dinner for like £25 and it's frozen and there are bits in it, but it's worth doing a quick look. There are ways and means of sort of stripping it down and still nobody wants anybody to have a miserable day. And that's the thing, because people are like, oh, I'm not going to bother with Christmas dinner. It's like, if you want it, there are ways of sort of constructing it without.
Do you know what? The science, it's been done so many times, giving presents is much more rewarding than getting it. And that's what Christmas plays on, actually, because we know it's a lovely feeling to buy someone something. So we know we're doing that. And I think that's a wonderful thing, though, about something like Kitmas, where you could go, I don't use this kit anymore, this shirt or whatever, and you can go and donate it. And I think that's a fantastic thing to give someone something. So just finally, because we're running out of time, is there anywhere these people should go to have a real good scout around, apart from your hot deals? Is there anywhere else that if people want to look around for stuff, what's the best thing to do apart from stand outside Ted Baker?
There are hundreds, like I said, Hot UK Deals is a great community because we've got a lot of people doing the work for you. So we say, don't search, just check. Because if you put a keyword into the search bar, it'll tell you, oh, this air fryer is available here. And it tells you when things are restocked as well. Like the customers are straight on the bat. Once they've got their PlayStation 5 in the basket, they're straight on Hot UK Deals going, this game store has PS5s. If you get in there now, get in there quick. But it's always worth, like things like I said, vouchercodes.co.uk is pretty good.
Which one was that? Voucher?
Vouchercodes.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Sites like Top Cashback and Quidco, which you get your free cashback for. Sign up once. You don't need to give away all your details. But even stupid stuff like the club card discount is ridiculous at the moment. Like the club card prices that you pay. And I know people are a bit annoyed about it because you're kind of forcing people to give your personal details. But I don't think Tesco cares about how many avocados I buy. So I'm quite happy with that. And then I stock up. Like this is fancy, this fancy coffee that's like Nescafe Zero that allegedly tastes like a coffee shop. And I'll buy 5 of them because they'll be like £2 instead of £8. And I really feel like Martin Lewis when I've got them in my basket. I'm like, I nailed this. I'm kicking consumerism in the face. So reward schemes and club cards and that kind of thing. Sign up for them all. Don't be loyal. They're called loyalty schemes. Don't be slutty. Use them all.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And what was the one you were saying about finding out if your neighbour had a banana about to go off?
That was flippant. And I feel sorry that I've defined it like that. Basically, there is a service called Olio, and that's an app, and it's all about community sharing. So it could be they've got some stuff that's in the fridge that they know that they're not going to use, or it could be something like, I need a drill. I need a Black & Decker and I haven't got one. Has anybody in the neighbourhood got one that, you know, maybe I could borrow? So it's a bit, there's a really nice filter, and you can put clothes on there now, which has changed my life because I've got so many clothes that don't fit me or aren't my style anymore. I always feel a bit guilty putting them directly into sort of a charity shop bin because I'm never sure if they get to the final destination. I feel a bit weird about it, but you can literally just put pictures up and people can just pop to your house and collect it. So if they've got a black tie event, you've got a black tie dress that doesn't fit you anymore because, you know, life happens, you can put it up. And yeah, so if you've got like interview outfits or stuff like that, it's a really nice service for that.
How are you spelling Olio? What?
O-L-I-O.
Oh, okay.
And there's Too Good To Go as well, which if you are willing to gamble, like at the end of the day, restaurants put their stock on there that hasn't been eaten. So you can get like an absolute steak baked bonanza at the end of the day from Greg's or whatever your local shop is. So that was pretty good. That's a good money saver.
Brilliant. Listen, thank you so much for joining me today. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Let's do a little plug for a few of your things. Your podcast, when's the next one out? Do we know? Yeah,
it's every Wednesday. So Foss Economy. We've got some guests coming up.
Okay.
But the back catalogue's brilliant as well. We've had some like proper pinch me people that I never thought I'd get to speak to. Like Nick Hancock was one, but like Dick and Dom as well. That was really surreal to be in the studio with them. And we've got one with Mark Watson's on, and it's a fun drinking game to work out who is speaking, whether it's Paul or Mark. I was in the room with them and sometimes I didn't know. So
yeah, they do sound similar. And when you're gigging next, when can people see you? Have you got any dates up yet?
Actually, I've got a really cool gig coming up on the 5th of December. It's called Cracking Comedy. It's at Leicester Square Theatre and it's for charity. It's a cause called Women and Children First. And it's all about funding community schemes for mothers and babies and children in developing countries. So it's less about sort of dropping aid to these countries and more about getting to the communities, finding out what they want and sort of enabling them to sort of build it for themselves. But the lineup is, I feel a little bit like a competition winner. I'm hosting it and I don't know how I got this gig. Like sometimes this happens to me, but it's like Mark Watson, Sophie Duker, Rosie Jones, Ian Sterling. It's a proper like pinch me lineup. It is an absolute steal. I am offended it's not sold out, to be honest. But so tickets are available for that.
And Vix, you're a great inspiration for people who are in a job and think, oh, I could do something else as well. Because I'm sure one day you'll dump the financial PR, won't you, and go totally comedy.
Do you know what? I'm not sure if I do, because they're dual loves for me. Like I do get a lot out of sort of PR for good. Like it is nice to be able to come and say, actually, you can save some money doing this. I've been building a career in it for about 15 years. So I think it's been really good for my work-life balance, because I made PR my whole life. My Twitter used to be at PR Vix, and I'd be checking my emails in the morning. And I was doing a job at the time where I did not need, nobody at 7 a.m. needed my comment on super drugs and new SIM card. But I got into the idea in my head that was a thing that I needed to do. And then I found comedy, and all of a sudden I had this hard stop. Like I had to finish on time because I had a gig to go to. And it really it switched my perspective a lot. So fingers crossed, I'd love to do comedy more, but whether or not I give up the personal finance, it's become a bit of a labour of love. So hopefully Foss Economy podcast works out, because then I can
thank you so much for joining me today. It's been wonderful. Oh,
thank you so much for having me. This has been such a treat. You are a genuine legend, and it's really nice to chat to you in real life.
Thank you very much.